Information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a grant that will help reduce Multnomah County's jail population.
President Trump was acquitted today on all impeachment charges.
And in international news, Greenpeace protesters chained themselves to oil barrels outside ARCO's headquarters in London.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 5th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Multnomah County received a $2 million grant from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation to help reduce the county's jail population through alternatives to pretrial detention. The county plans to reduce its average daily jail population by 14.4% in 2 years. It will also study providing more services for people with mental illness and drug or alcohol addictions, and reducing the racial and ethnic disparities in the jail. A 2019 study showed that the overrepresentation of Black and Latinx people in the county's adult criminal justice system and the racial disparity in their arrests has grown since 2014. Multnomah County is one of 5 areas receiving these funds from the MacArthur Foundation.
There could soon be a big hulk hanging over Portland resident and tourist favorite, the East Bank Esplanade, and that's Interstate 5. The controversial proposed expansion of I-5 through the Rose Quarter would send a couple lanes of concrete right over parts of the Esplanade. City government, however, must agree to this and could negotiate for compensatory improvements to the Esplanade. The project has already raised objections because of its ever-increasing cost and the environmental impact on the neighborhood that includes Harriet Tubman Middle School. Bob Salinger, president of the Audubon Society of Portland, said the new roadway, quote, would jut out over the Esplanade, essentially making it into something of a cave, increasing noise, increasing pollution, increasing shadowing. The City Parks Bureau is currently negotiating with ODOT about this project.
The short legislative session has begun in the Oregon State Legislature, and people in the agriculture industry have their eye on a cap-and-invest bill that is set to modify statewide greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
With tensions high in Salem as lawmakers began work on a cap-and-invest bill, one organization is reminding legislators that voices in agriculture are not a monolith on this issue. The Oregon Climate and Agriculture Network, representing more than 250 farmers and ranchers across the state, is calling for strong climate action this session, including passing the Cap and Invest bill. Taylor Starr, head of White Oak Farm in Southern Oregon, believes many of the farm lobbying groups against Cap and Invest are in the pocket of the big ag industry.
Getting a balanced perspective from the agricultural community and the small farming community and the organic farming community, you see that there's a lot of farmers who are experiencing already the impacts of climate change and are really excited about the possibilities with this bill.
Starr is concerned about growing drought in the region and bigger wildfire seasons, which can be hazardous to his workers as well as his crops. Other groups, such as Timber Unity, believe a bill to cap emissions threatens their livelihood. The group of loggers, truckers, and farmers holds a rally in Salem on Thursday, the same day as the bill's second public hearing. Mimi Castile, a grower with Hopewell Wine in Salem, says she understands the razor's edge agricultural producers live on. However, she adds this bill has robust protections for farms and forests, and thinks the agricultural sector can play a big role in reversing the effects of climate change.
This bill makes space to start those conversations and start breaking down the fence lines that we think are between us, because we all are truly the front lines of what stands to be our only defense against the climate stress that's coming.
Sarah Doimling owns Xena Forest Products with her family in the Willamette Valley, outside Salem. She says her forest has lost more than 10% of its Douglas fir trees in the past 7 years from the effects of a warming climate. She believes climate change is the biggest threat to Oregonians' way of life.
We would like a much stronger climate bill than the one that has appeared in the legislature so far, but we feel strongly that the cost of inaction will be much greater to us than the cost of action.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Today was the 14th and final day of the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. As expected, the Senate voted along mostly party lines to acquit the president of the charges against him, finding Trump not guilty of the first article of impeachment, abuse of power, by 52 to 48 votes, and not guilty of the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress, by a vote of 53 to 47. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah joined House Democrats on the first of the two counts, saying his conscience compelled him to fulfill his oath of office and vote to convict Trump on the charge of abuse of power.
As a senator juror, I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. I am profoundly religious. My faith is at the heart of who I am. I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong. So the verdict is ours to render under our Constitution. The people will judge us for how well and faithfully we fulfill our duty. The grave question the Constitution tasks senators to answer is whether the president committed an act so extreme and egregious that it rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Yes, he did. The president asked a foreign government to investigate his political rival. The president withheld vital military funds from that government to press it to do so. The president delayed funds for an American ally at war with Russian invaders. The president's purpose was personal and political. Accordingly, the president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust. What he did was not perfect. No, it was a flagrant assault on our electoral rights, our national security, and our fundamental values. Corrupting an election to keep oneself in office is perhaps the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine. I'm aware that there are people in my party and in my state who will strenuously disapprove of my decision, and in some quarters I will be vehemently denounced. I'm sure to hear abuse from the president and his supporters. Does anyone seriously believe that I would consent to these consequences other than from an inescapable conviction that my oath before God demanded it of me? As it is with each senator, my vote is an act of conviction. We've come to different conclusions, fellow senators, but I trust we have all followed the dictates of our conscience. I acknowledge that my verdict will not remove the president from office. The results of this Senate court will in fact be appealed to a higher court, the judgment of the American people. Voters will make the final decision, just as the president's lawyers have implored. My vote will likely be in the minority in the Senate. But irrespective of these things, with my vote, I will tell my children and their children that I did my duty to the best of my ability, believing that my country expected it of me. I will only be one name among many, no more, no less, to future generations of Americans who look at the record of this trial. They will note merely that I was among the senators who determined that what the president did was wrong, grievously wrong.
That was Senator Mitt Romney of Utah. Meanwhile, Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado talked about history and the stakes of this trial.
Over the years that I've been here, Madam President, as I have seen this institution crumble into rubble, this institution become incapable of addressing the most existential questions of our time, that the next generation cannot address. They can't fix their own school. They can't fix our immigration system. They can't fix climate change, although they're getting less and less patient with us on that issue. But what I've come to conclude is that the responsibility of all of us, not just senators, but all of us as citizens in a democratic republic, 230 years after the founding of this republic, is the responsibility of a founder. That it's that elevated a sense of what a citizen is required to do in a republic to sustain that republic. And I think that's the right way to think about it. It gives you a sense of what's really at stake beyond the headlines on the cable television at night, and certainly in the social media feeds that divide us minute to minute in our political life today. And the Senate has clearly failed that standard. We have clearly failed that standard. The idea that we would turn our back, close our eyes to evidence pounding on the outside of the doors of this Capitol is pitiful. It is disgraceful. And it will be a stain on this body for all time. More than 50% of the people in this place have said that what the president did was wrong. It clearly was wrong. It clearly was unconstitutional. It clearly was impeachable. What president would run for office saying to the American people, I'm going to try to extort a foreign power for my own electoral interest to interfere in our elections? It is exactly the kind of conduct that the impeachment clause was written for. It is a textbook case of why the impeachment clause exists. But even if you don't agree with me that he should have been convicted, or that he should be convicted, I don't know how anybody in this body goes home and faces their constituents and say, we wouldn't even look at the evidence. And so I say to the American people, our democracy is very much at risk.
That was Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado today. The vote took place this afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern Time amidst protests outside and inside the Capitol Rotunda by people demanding that senators, quote, remember their oath, end quote, and find Trump guilty. As Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin said, quote, this is not an exoneration of Donald Trump. It is a failure to show moral courage and hold this president accountable, end quote. The trial concluded without having heard from a single witness or having any documents presented as evidence. More than 270, quote, reject the cover-up, end quote, protests are being held in 45 states and the District of Columbia this evening.
The State of the Union yesterday began with Trump refusing Pelosi's handshake and ended with Pelosi tearing up Trump's speech. In between, failed Venezuelan coup leader Juan Guaido got a standing ovation, Parkland victim Father Fred Gutenberg got kicked out, and Rush Limbaugh got the Presidential Medal of Freedom. 10 Democrats, including Earl Blumenauer and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, boycotted the president's address. In his speech, Trump said nothing about his impeachment. He also avoided a topic many scientists say is the, quote, defining issue of the 21st century, climate change.
In a joint statement released on Tuesday, 9 conservation groups have come up with the consensus that Donald Trump has been, quote, the worst president for our environment in history, end quote. The statement was released out of concern that Trump would try to, quote, greenwash, end quote, his record during the speech. According to the New York Times, as of the end of last year, the Trump administration had attempted to roll back more than 90 environmental rules and regulations. These include removing carbon dioxide emission standards from oil and gas plants and stripping environmental protections from streams and wetlands. The New York Times also fact-checked a claim by Trump in which he said his policy changes have made the United States the number one producer of oil and natural gas. In fact, the United States was already the world's leading gas producer since 2009 and the world's leading oil producer since 2013. In any case, these conservation groups and many other groups worldwide agree that, quote, unfortunately, our children will pay the costs of this president's recklessness.
The White House on Wednesday threatened to veto a House bill that would provide billions of dollars in funding for earthquake relief in Puerto Rico. The legislation would allocate $4.7 billion in funds after the island, still reeling from 2017's Hurricane Maria, was racked by multiple earthquakes last month. The White House said in its veto threat, quote, neither Puerto Ricans nor the American taxpayers benefit when emergency aid is misallocated, lost, or stolen through waste, fraud, and abuse, end quote. Trump has long expressed skepticism about providing aid to Puerto Rico while simultaneously praising his administration's response to Hurricane Maria. A government commissioned study recently found that nearly 3,000 people died as a result of the hurricane and its aftermath.
It was literally solar panels versus fossil fuels as protesters in London blocked access to ARCO's headquarters with 500 of the solar panels. Several of the 100 Greenpeace UK protesters locked themselves to oil barrels outside the building, all in greeting to the company's new CEO, Bernard Looney, on his first day of work. Police prevented activists from installing the solar panels on the sidewalk. Greenpeace UK climate campaigner Richard George said, quote, their new CEO needs to accept that if BP wants to keep trading in the 21st century, they need to switch to 100% renewable energy. Yesterday, Greenpeace was granted permission by the High Court to legally challenge BP's latest drilling permit on the grounds that the company failed to properly consult the public.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is an 80% chance of rain with a low of 47. Tomorrow's weather will be an 80% chance of rain with a high of 54. Today in history, in 1917, Congress overrode President Woodrow Wilson's veto of the Immigration Act. The law required a literacy test for immigrants and barred most Asiatic laborers. The quote of the day is from baseball great Hank Aaron, who turned 86 today. I never doubted my ability, but when you hear all your life you're inferior, it makes you wonder if the other guys have something you've never seen before. If they do, I'm still looking for it.
A 32-year-old U.S. citizen arrested by Border Patrol in Texas died in custody on Tuesday. According to a Customs and Border Protection statement, the man, quote, began exhibiting signs of distress, end quote, and was taken to a nearby hospital where he was pronounced dead less than 6 hours after his arrest. The agency, which falls under the purview of the Department of Homeland Security, has previously faced scrutiny over its handling of people in custody, especially following the deaths of several children in 2018 and 2019.
33 rescue workers in eastern Turkey today were killed by an avalanche while trying to help victims of an earlier avalanche. The first avalanche on Tuesday hit a passenger van, knocking it off a road and down a steep slope and killing at least 5 people. Nearly 300 people were searching on Wednesday morning for victims still buried in the snow, and some 30 emergency workers were either rescued or escaped from underneath the snow and were hospitalized. Several workers are still missing, with more rescue personnel on their way to the scene. Last week, the nearby province of Elazığ was hit by a magnitude 6.7 earthquake, killing 41 people and injuring more than 1,600.
An airplane flying into Istanbul's Sabiha Gökçen International Airport skidded off the runway today and crashed in a field, injuring at least 120 people. The plane broke into 3 pieces, and passengers were seen evacuating through cracks in the aircraft. The Boeing 737 was operated by Turkish carrier Pegasus Airlines and was flying in from the port city of Izmir on Turkey's western coast. Governor Ali Yerlikaya, who attributed the accident to poor weather in the region, said today that the plane slid for 200 feet and then fell about 100 feet down a bank. This is the second crash the airline is facing in less than a month. The first crash was a Boeing 737 flight from Ankara to Trabzon, Turkey, on January 13th of this year, in which, while landing, the flight ran off the left side of the runway and partially slid down a cliff.
Finland is set to increase its parental leave standards to a combined 14 months, working out to 160 days, or nearly 7 months paid leave per parent after the birth of a child. This move, says Finland, is to, quote, promote well-being and gender equality, end quote, and follows in the footsteps of neighboring Sweden, which allows 240 days for each parent. In Finland, on average, only 1 in 4 fathers takes their parental leave, so the increase is also a push to get both parents to spend more time with their children. It appears the European Union is headed in the same direction, with a 2019 directive instructing countries to provide at least 4 months' leave for each parent. Notably, the United States is one of only 2 countries in the world that does not offer paid parental leave. The other is Papua New Guinea.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is reminded that all politics are local politics.
Since I'm organically surrealist, I know now I was born at the right time. Rush Limbaugh, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, freedom to hate, freedom to shun and harm those of different colors and beliefs. It's America with a K, the untied states of amnesia. Donnie was such a grade school turd, refusing to shake hands with Pelosi, she grade schooled back, ripping up his speech. The Democrats imploded in Iowa and keep showing they'd rather have Donnie than Bernie. So since the reign of DT will continue, what do we do? 4 out of 5 spots on the Portland City Council, including mayor, are up for our votes. So are all our Congress reps, including Earl Blumenauer, who boycotted the State of the Union. Otherwise, it's not a matter of politics, but community. Face to face, working together, we can do this, aligned with no party but those we hold to celebrate what we've accomplished. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Writer and rocker Patti Smith will receive Penn's 2020 Literary Service Award, given to an individual making an impact on culture and the human condition. Previous winners include Toni Morrison, Philip Roth, and Margaret Atwood. One small example of Smith's community activity happened recently when she heard of the January 1st break-in and robbery of Portland's Passages Bookshop. Smith phoned store owner David Abel, then sent him autographed copies of several of her works. Smith will receive the award at Penn's annual gala on May 19th at the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
President Trump gave his State of the Union address yesterday and notably didn't mention Native Americans beyond bringing up Manifest Destiny, a belief that allows the United States government to justify its expansion throughout the Americas. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump delivered his State of Union address Tuesday. It stirred up some partisan rancor on both sides of the aisle. While he did not mention Indian country specifically, that partisan difference was noticed by Native American members of Congress. Reporter Vaughn Golden spoke with two of four Native Americans in Congress.
President Trump touted a wide array of policies in his address, including wage growth, agriculture, and broadband deployment. Republican Chickasaw Congressman Tom Cole believes the positives the president touted trickled down to Indian country as well.
Obviously, there are a lot of goals there that I don't care what your background or ethnicity is, you can share.
He pointed to things like the military and broadband deployment. Democratic Congresswoman Deb Haaland disagrees. She doesn't believe the president's address was relevant to tribes at all.
No, not one bit. He essentially, you know, in his last sort of the ending of the speech when he was recounting the history of our country, you notice he never mentioned Native Americans one time.
This is Haaland's second State of the Union address. I'm Vaughn Golden, National Native News.
In President Trump's State of the Union speech, he referred to Manifest Destiny, which Native scholars point to as the justification by the U.S. for the taking of land and the removal and genocide of Native Americans. Trump said, "In reaffirming our heritage as a free nation, we must remember that America has always been a frontier nation. Now we must embrace the next frontier, America's Manifest Destiny in the stars." A proposed multi-billion-dollar pipeline expansion in Western Canada has overcome another major legal challenge. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, several Native groups in British Columbia are challenging the project.
The First Nations bands argue that they were never properly consulted and that the federal government had already decided to approve the project before any consultations in 2018 and 2019. But in a unanimous decision, the Federal Appeals Court ruled that the government made a genuine effort at consultations by listening to and considering the issues raised by the First Nations. Native leaders say they were disappointed by the ruling and vowed to fight on.
Tsleil-Waututh, and I'm speaking only on behalf of Tsleil-Waututh, we stand on our own Indigenous law, and when we say that this project cannot go through, we're standing on our own Indigenous law and on the path laid forward for us by our ancestors.
Ottawa welcomed the ruling. So too did Alberta Premier Jason Kenney. He said the Trans Mountain Pipeline project had already gone through years of the most detailed and rigorous environmental reviews and Indigenous consultation. He also said many Native groups support the project. The pipeline expansion would triple the amount of Alberta oil piped to the West Coast to about 900,000 barrels a day. First Nations leaders say they are consulting with their lawyers and councils and will appeal the decision to the Supreme Court of Canada. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
North Dakota Native Vote is hosting an official launch Wednesday in Bismarck. The advocacy group works to organize and fight a 2018 voter ID law, which Native groups, tribal leaders, and advocates say suppresses the Native vote. Tawny Kell is the organization's secretary.
They were requiring North Dakotans to have a physical address on their identification in order to be eligible to vote. And if you live on the reservation, you do not have a physical address, you have a P.O. box. So this group was formed, boots on the ground, working to get people their IDs, to get people to the polls, to get people to vote, which actually led to a record number of turnout.
The group is engaging with tribal communities and allies on Native vote issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Iowa Democratic Party released partial results yesterday, including a tight race against Sanders and Buttigieg. With more on this story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
This year, we're reporting out more data than we ever have reported before. And in addition to that, we have paper trails that we've never had before. And so we're going to take the time we need to verify these results. But these results are being based off what happened in the precincts last night.
Iowa Democratic Party Chair Troy Price addressed reporters ahead of yesterday's late release of some of the results from Monday night's long-awaited Iowa Democratic caucuses. The paper trail preference cards have to get into Des Moines from each of the state's 1,681 precincts, where party officials hand-verify the votes. The app couldn't handle the three sets of numbers, results of the first round of the caucuses, the second, and then how many delegates each candidate will get.
We're going to walk out of here with our share of delegates. We don't know exactly what it is yet, but we feel good about where we are.
All those who shared the most recent debate stage will get some delegates. With just over a third left of precincts to report, former Vice President Joe Biden was in fourth place, behind former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, but that could all change. The Wisconsin Examiner's Ruth Conniff commented on the significance of Iowa's results.
There's only 41 delegates in Iowa, so it's not going to be a big deal as far as the actual delegate count for the candidates, but it creates an impression that can really drive momentum.
That impression could be very mixed this year. State delegates are apportioned based on historical turnout, giving rural areas more delegates per person than bigger cities. So two candidates could declare victory based on votes or delegates. At one point in the count, Sanders led in votes and Buttigieg in state delegates.
The message that Iowa has sent to the nation, the message shared by the American people, is that we want a government that represents all of us.
Democrats hungry to win, independent voters who had been turned off by our politics, Republicans tired of trying to look their kids in the eye and explain this presidency.
While overall 50% of Americans disapprove of his presidency, according to the latest Gallup poll, Trump's approval rating is now at his personal best, 49%. He gave the State of the Union last night while the Senate votes today on whether to remove him from office. No matter what, the candidates are moving on. Warren spoke in Keene, New Hampshire yesterday.
We've got 55 more states and territories all around this country that want their voices heard.
New Hampshire primaries are next Tuesday. Nevada Democrats caucus later this month, and after seeing what happened in Iowa, they're opting out of the app that failed in the Hawkeye state. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
Now, we have a guest in studio with us. Welcome, Camilo Marquez, who is a volunteer with the nonprofit BARC. BARC is an Oregon watchdog organization dedicated to protecting, preserving, and transforming Mount Hood National Forest. Their work has helped shape numerous timber